Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, James Van Pelt. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I am Edward Willett, I'm your host, and I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My most recent release would be Star Song, which is a young adult science fiction novel, very much in the manner of Robert A. Heinlein and Andre Norton. It's published by Shadowpaw Press, and I'm pleased to say that it is a finalist for this year's Aurora Award. That's Canada's top award for science fiction and fantasy. And it's a finalist for a Best Young Adult Novel with some really stiff and impressive competition, so I'm very pleased about that. Anyone who is a Canadian citizen or resident can vote in the Aurora Awards. You simply have to join the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. It's $10, which is not much, and then you can vote and also then nominate next year for the Aurora Awards. And you can join by going to priauroraawards.com, priauroraawards.com, priauroraawards.com. And one of the great things about buying your membership and so that you can vote in the Auroras is that you can also get the voters package, which will have any number of short stories and other things in there, including Star Song. So you can actually read it for only $10 if you join the Canadian Science Fiction Fantasy Association and then vote for the Auroras. Of course, it'd be nice if you voted for Star Song, but you would vote for whomever it is that you feel deserves the reward. So that was exciting news recently. And then the other thing, of course, was the Kickstarter that I ran in March, which I've already mentioned in a previous episode, succeeded. And that's very exciting because that means that there will be a Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 this fall, which will be featuring authors who were guests on this podcast during its third year, just as the original Shapers of Worlds, which you can buy through bookstoread.com. That's a numeral 2, bookstoread.com/Shapers of Worlds. Which featured first-year guests, and then the second one was Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, which, similarly, you can get bookstoread.com/Shapers of Worlds 2. So those two are available, and there'll be a third one this fall, which I'm working on now. I'm starting to get stories. I'll soon be editing. I'm issuing contracts. I'm giving money to authors. I always like to do that. That's all in the works and will be coming up this fall. And, of course, that's published by my own publishing company, Shadowpaw Press, which you can find at shadowpawpress.com. And Shadowpaw Press also has another new release, not mine, called Duotero by Brad C. Anderson, originally published by Bundoran Press. Duotero is a wonderful far future science fiction story about a lost human colony struggling to survive against the alien ecosystem in which it finds itself embedded with no help coming from the home planet anymore. So it's Duotero, D-U-A-T-E-R-O, by Brad C. Anderson. I urge you to check that out, either at the Shadowpaw Press site or at wherever fine books are sold. I also have another release called Stay by Catherine Lawrence, which is not science fiction or fantasy. It's actually a middle grade novel in verse about an 11-year-old girl who really wants a dog, and at the same time her family's kind of coming apart at the seams. It's a wonderful little story, and it's all told in verse. It's called Stay. And there'll be much more coming out through that side of Shadowpaw Press, Shadowpaw Press Reprise, where I publish republish previously published books for which the rights have reverted to the authors, usually because some other publisher has gone away. And if you are such an author who has such a book, feel free to reach out to me and see if I might be interested in bringing it back onto the market. Shadowpaw Press Premier, which publishes new stuff, will have a couple of new titles this fall, including the Shapers of Worlds Volume 3 anthology. There will be a young adult novel called The Emir's Falcon by Matt Hughes, who was a guest on this podcast, but who is also writes outside the genre, and this is a sort of modern-day outdoor adventure story. And a novel called Thickwood by Gail M. Smith, which is about a young woman who comes back to Saskatchewan post-World War, has to make some decisions about her future as her as the horse ranch she grew up on is being swallowed by the community pasture, and meanwhile, she's just come back from playing in the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. So it combines baseball and horses, and it's quite a wonderful book I'm looking forward to bringing out. And Shadow Paw Press Premier will open to submissions at some point and will always be open to science fiction and fantasy. But as you can tell, I'm also open to other things. But I haven't quite come to the point where I'm going to say submissions are open just yet. Still taking it easy, feeling my way through this whole publishing side of things. All right, well, that's probably way too much introductory material. Let's get on to this episode's guest, James Van Pelt. James Van Pelt is a former high school English teacher who is now a full-time science fiction, fantasy, and horror writer, among other things. His short stories have appeared in numerous magazines and anthologies, including Asimov's, Analog, Tailbones, Realms of Fantasy, Weird Tales, and others. He has 8 books out, including 6 short story collections, Strangers and Beggars, The Last of the O-Forms and Other Stories, The Radio Magician and Other Stories, Flying in the Heart of the Lafayette Escadrille, The Experience Arcade, and The Best of James Van Pelt. His 2 novels are Summer of the Apocalypse and Pandora's Gun. He's been a Nebula finalist and a John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer finalist and has been nominated for Pushcart Prizes. His first collection was named a Best Book for Young Adults by the American Library Association, and more recently he won the Colorado Book Award. Many of his short stories have appeared in various year's best collections, and he lives in Colorado. So, Jim, welcome to the World Shapers.
Thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
I always look for connections, and our connection is kind of an odd one. I picked up on a writing exercise that you had created called the 7-sentence short story, and I may have done it more than you have by this point. I keep doing it as a workshop at conventions and when I'm working with young writers and stuff like that. It's a very, very fun little plotting exercise.
I've never had it fail for me, and it's always interesting to get to the end of a session like that and then ask everybody to look at what they've done and said, look, you know, no matter how awful it might be, it's a complete short story. They always end up with a complete short story if they follow instructions.
And I find that my own short stories, when I do it, I've discovered that I can write very, very long sentences when I'm trying to cram a short story into 7 sentences. The semicolons and colons and dashes are your friend when it comes to getting as many words in there as possible. Well, you're a little different from most of my guests in that you're not primarily a novelist. You're primarily a short story writer, so that will be interesting. But first, I want to take you. I'm tired of. I always say back into the mists of time, but that's getting old. How about into the depths of history? Does that sound better?
Maybe not. I'm up for it.
How did you? Well, first of all, where did you grow up and all that stuff? And how did you get interested in writing?
Well, I was born in Ohio. But I was in Colorado where I grew up by the time I was 4, so all my memories were from that time. And I think like most writers, I started off as a reader. My mom and dad would never buy me candy if I wanted it or toys. You know, they said, well, your birthday's coming up and that might be 4 months away and stuff. But they would always buy me a book if I asked for a book. And so we'd go book hunting. I'd go to the library all the time. I read through all of the science fiction and fantasy offerings in our local library's kids section, it seemed to me, in about a summer. I did it all in the summer. And so they gave me permission to go into the adult section to look for science fiction books, which I did. I think I was doing that by the 4th or 5th grade. And that science fiction bent probably came from my dad, who was an actual rocket scientist. He was an aeronautical engineer for Martin Marietta and was a part of the early American space program. They did a lot of military contracts. Sometimes he'd tell me he couldn't tell me what he was working on because it was top secret. But he loved, just really loved science fiction film. So we would go to the drive-in, and this is the late 50s, early 60s, all the Godzilla movies, all the 1950 monster films, those great 1950s movies like The Day the Earth Stood Still or Invasion of the Body Snatchers. If we didn't see them in the theater, I would see them either on Friday nights where we did sci-fi flicks with the local television station, or a Saturday night where they did creature features, also on a local television station. So a lot of movies in there, and ordering books that look science fictional from the Weekly Reader Book Club, asking for books for Christmas presents. The writing end of it, I think that I always admired the idea of the writer. I was really, really disappointed when I found out that the Hardy Boys wasn't an actual person, that it was a house name. Mm-hmm. That was a big blow because I wanted to meet that guy. And but the other writers, I just thought it was so wonderful to be able to do that with words. But like most kids, the idea of writing anything at length was a nightmare. If someone gave me a 2-page paper to do in fourth grade over the weekend, right? Come back on Monday with 2 pages that you've written about something, anything. It was awful. The idea of getting to the edge of the second page, I was writing big. I was, you know, big margins. If I could do crayon, I would have. It just seemed impossible. So how could anybody write a book? That was the science fictional thing. How could a book be accomplished? But about fourth grade or fifth grade, I think it was fourth grade, I discovered Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles. And those stories were just amazing. Every single one of them were amazing. But not only were they amazing, a couple of them were only 1 page long. I thought, well, I can't do a novel, but maybe I could, you know, if I really stretched myself, do a page. So I did some. I tried some. I didn't do a lot. I don't want anybody to think that I was like a young Emily Bronte or something. You know, I wrote a little bit. I admired the idea of writing from a distance, mostly. But I did like it when I was given story writing assignments in English class. I had a tendency to write science fictionally. I think the very first story I wrote was a kind of a fantasy slash science fiction thing about a sentient bolt, just a little bolt that was holding on the front wheel of a race car, and how it had to fight to keep the race and the race car going, and how the car is starting to fall apart and only this single bolt is holding it together. And at the end, the race car finishes first, but still wrecks a little bit. The driver walks away, but the car is trashed and my sentient bolt is lying in a pool of battery acid dissolving. And a very bleak ending for a fourth grader, but it was triumphant because it had done its job. It's sort of like the little engine that could if it ended tragically. That was my first story.
I always, I've mentioned it many times on here, but my first short story written when I was about 11, first complete short story, because I dabbled before that too, but again, it was hard to finish anything, was called Castra Glass Hypership Test Pilot. So my course was set very early on as well when it came to what kind of subject matter I was going to be focusing on.
I read exclusively science fiction. Fantasy didn't even really exist, except I did like a good ghost story when I read it, and I liked Edgar Allan Poe, but I didn't see him as a different genre. Or if he was a different genre, he was the Edgar Allan Poe genre. He was just this outlier in all the literature that I read who was so awesome. But anything I bought, it was all science fiction. I tried to read The Hobbit, I think, in junior high, and the weird names. And it sounded like a kid's book in the first few pages, and so I didn't read it. It wasn't till I think I was 20 and in the student union at my college waiting for my next class, somebody had left a copy of the Fellowship of the Rings on a table. It was just this abandoned paperback, and I picked it up, and I lost 4 days of classes because I couldn't put it down, and I go through the next 2 books and then go back and read The Hobbit. And it wasn't until then that I thought fantasy was worth paying attention to as a writer. I wanted to write science fiction. I wanted to be Ray Bradbury. I wanted to be Robert Heinlein.
It took me a while to warm up to The Hobbit too. I remember trying to read it at about that same age, and it was just, but what? It's so slow, and what is all this? And he lives in a hole? I don't get it. you'd also mentioned going into the adult side to read science fiction. The librarian actually called my mother aside one day and said, your son is going into the adult side of the library. And my mother said, it's okay. He only reads science fiction. And I thought, Mom, you don't actually know what's in these books I'm reading, do you? Some of those 60s science fiction novels. So did you, as you got older and you got into high school, did you write more and longer and more complete? Or
any? I wrote more, but I turned to poetry. I think because it was easy to complete. I liked, I'd read The Green Hills of Earth, Robert Heinlein's short story about the, you know, the poet of the spaceways, Rissling. And I love those poems, and I wanted to be able to write poems too. I thought that would be neat. Plus, I thought girls would go for the sensitive poet type. I was wrong about that, as it turned out. But I did like writing poems, and that's where I made my first publications, was getting poems placed in the school's literary magazine. When I went to college and I was picking classes, I picked a lot of creative writing classes, and that's where I started to write more short stories, because I was allowed to, and it was a lot better than taking... I decided I was going to be a PE minor when I went into college. I was going to be a history major so I could teach history and be a PE minor. But I looked at the PE minor course requirements, and one of them was interpretive dance. And something about that at 18, just, I said, no way. But I saw I could get an English minor if I took a lot of creative writing classes. And I liked reading and writing anyways. And fortunately, the creative writing instructor that I took first at Metro State College in Denver was Vance Andahl, which is a name most people don't remember now. But in the 60s, he was selling a lot of short fiction. He sold to Playboy and the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. And here he was as the creative writing teacher at the college I was going to. So he encouraged me to write the things that I wanted to write, which were science fictional, in science fiction poetry. His class was cool. The first day we all met as a class, and then after that, he just set up individual conferences for us. We came in once a week, showed him what we'd written, we discussed it, and he'd come back next week. It was like that for a semester. It was great.
Oh, I wish I'd had a class like that. I often ask people who've had formal creative writing classes in university if they were, you know, able to write this kind of stuff, and some really did run into a lot of opposition to anything that was tainted by the science fiction or fantasy brush, but it sounds like you really kind of lucked out there.
Well, I lucked out with Vance Andahl. The other creative writing classes, I think all the creative writing classes as an underclassman were with Vance, and that almost completed my English minor. It was an amazing number of classes and not a very hard minor. Then when I started teaching, I decided that I didn't like teaching history as much as I liked studying history, because the history classroom, I found in the high school, the students are about 50% neutral on the subject, because they're neutral on anything. So if you're okay, they're okay. And maybe one or two kids in the class are really enthusiastic about it, and they're the next generation's history teachers. And the rest of the class hate it. So it's 25% who can't see the relevance of what you're teaching at all, in the least. And I couldn't convince them that it was relevant. And I didn't like that headwind, but I was doing a substitute teaching, and I did one of my student teachings in the English classroom, and I found even the most reluctant student in the English classroom, the kid who hated school most, if you talked to him, he would grudgingly admit that it was important to be able to understand what people say to you, to be able to speak, to be understood, and to be able to read to understand. So there was buy-in there, even among kids who did not like school, that wasn't present in the history class.
Did you, you taught in one school for a very long time. Did you move around a bit and then finally settle, or how did that all?
No, I was a swim coach when I swam competitively in college, and I was coaching swim teams from the time I graduated from high school. And I'd found a really good position coaching a team that paid me more than I would get paid if I was teaching. But I got to the point where I couldn't talk to an adult human being unless it was about swimming. And I wanted to be able to talk about books and movies and the things I was writing or wanting to write. And I just felt like staying in coaching was terrible. So I started applying for teaching jobs. Ironically, the only way I could get a teaching job is if I went in as the school's swim coach. Mm-hmm. So I got a job on the western slope of Colorado in Fruita Monument. It's a smaller town near the Utah border, who needed a coach for their swim team. And then I stayed there for 31 years. I didn't go anywhere. When I decided to retire, which I decided to retire pretty young, I retired officially in 2014. That was when I was 60. And I did it because my dad had Alzheimer's. And I was looking at his, you know, path, going from being a rocket scientist and just really good with all kinds of stuff to not being able to figure the tip on a bill. And I thought, the thing I really want to do is write. I'd been writing all the time I'd been teaching. I made my first story sale in 1989, and I'd started teaching in 1981. So writing had always been a part of it. The dream of writing had always been a part of it. I thought, I want to retire and just write while I'm still capable of it. And not necessarily my dad's path will be my path, but it is genetically linked. And not very many of us can, you know, get to 100 like Betty White or something and still be funny and articulate. And a lot of us aren't. So I wanted to write, and that's what I did. I did a couple years teaching half-time at another high school at the end of my career, but that was it. The rest of the time was at the one high school.
And so you sold your first story in 1989. Who did you sell it to?
It was a little magazine called After Hours. It was a staple-stitched magazine, and the story I wrote was kind of a horror story, a little bit, not totally a horror story. But I'd been sending stories off since the mid-'80s. I have a rejection in my rejection file from the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction from 1984. I think that's the oldest one I still hold on to, although there might have been a couple older ones than that. But I sold one to After Hours. I got a phone call at my apartment where I was living when I was doing grad school at the University of California, Davis. And the guy on the other end started talking to me about a story I'd written. And he didn't tell me who he was. So I thought he was another student, somebody else in the program who'd read the story, or maybe one of my professors. It took me a minute or so before I realized that it was an editor. And he was calling me because he wanted to buy the story. But After Hours had this little editorial requirement that every story in the magazine, one scene in it, has to take place at night. Hence, After Hours. Uh-huh. That's the title of it. So I changed part of one sentence and he bought the story.
I found out about my first sale. I was in Zurich, of all places, on a chorus tour. And an airmail caught up to me from my mother and said, "Oh, you got an acceptance for a story you'd written."
Oh, that is awesome. It was cool. Well, I think everybody's first story sale, I think, is just so much fun. I was at Worldcon, and I was sitting in the front row, because I always sit in the front row, and Gardner Dozois and Stan Schmidt and, I don't know, maybe Gordon Van Gelder. I was all the big names and editors up in front at the same time. And I was sitting next to a guy. And we had been talking before the panelists started to speak. And he had told me that he'd been submitting stuff out. And he was also an artist. And he also wanted to do cover illustrations. And that's a pretty rare combination. There aren't very many people that do both, right in the art. But while they were talking, Stan Schmidt said, well, you know, while we're talking about acceptances, I recently took a story by this person who also did the art for it, and I've never bought one like that before, but I was wondering if it's here, and he announced the name. And the guy who was sitting next to me did this really complicated twitch. It was him. That's how he learned about his first story sale, sitting in an audience at a WorldCon.
Yeah, that's a good one. I could almost do a whole podcast just talking to people about their first story sales. So you've always been very short story focused, it seems to me. You have written a couple of novels, but you've clearly written. Do you have any idea how many stories you've had published in total at this point?
178.
Oh, you actually do keep. That's impressive.
I have a running list. It numbers them when I add them. So that's how I know.
I once had a reporter get mad at me because I didn't know how many books I'd written. She was in Moose Jaw, so it wasn't like a major outlet or anything. But for some reason, she was quite offended that I couldn't say precisely how many books I'd had published with all the various, you know, work for hire and educational publisher work and all that stuff.
If you said that in front of a crowd at any panel at a well-attended convention, a certain number of people in the group would just hate you for that. You don't remember how many books you've sold? You don't remember when they're just dying to make their first sale.
Well, and fair enough. I probably would have felt the same way when I was trying to sell my first one, which seemed to take a very, very long time. So 178 short stories so far. So let's move on to talking about how you do it. So what is your... Okay, we'll start at the very beginning. Every writer hates the question, where do you get your ideas? So rephrase that if you wish, but nevertheless, where do you get your ideas? How do they come to you?
Well, I know why the most writers hate it. It's because they never have any particular reason to engage with it. Their ideas, however they come to them. So that part of the process feels somewhat magic to them. But I've been teaching creative writing and writing in general since 1981. So I'm constantly talking to students who have no idea at all that they're going to be writing something that day to start writing something. And so you got pretty self-conscious about how I get my own ideas, because I wanted to talk to them about that. I didn't want to just tell them, well, wait till the magic hits and you'll find something to write about. So I think that the main difference between the working writers like myself and you and a lot of the people you've interviewed is that we're so entrenched in writing and creating that we're constantly paying attention to the ideas that most people have all the time, but just let flit by, or they dismiss them as not being very interesting. I don't dismiss anything as not being interesting. I pay attention to everything, and anything can become an idea. But where this, my own consciousness about my idea production came through to me most was in 2015, I'd reread an article by Ray Bradbury that I'd read bunches of times before, because Bradbury's Zen and the Art of Writing is such a good book. And in it, he had suggested his advice to new writers was that they write a story a week for a year. And he said, it's because no one's capable of producing 52 bad stories in a row. I thought that was funny. But I wasn't a young writer or a new writer by 2015. I'd been publishing for 25 years. But I liked the idea of producing a lot of work and seeing what I could learn from doing that. So I started it. I started a story week. It was in February of 2015. And I wrote one every week for the whole year. So finished up in 2016. And doing that many stories in a row made me become much more aware of where story ideas were coming from, because most of the time I'd finish my story for the week on Sunday, and Monday's the beginning of my new week, and I have to come up with something. So I would be sitting there on Monday if something hadn't occurred to me during the week before that I was eager to get to, and I would just start thinking about what's on my mind. What do I pay attention to? What are my obsessions today? And out of those come the stories that I end up writing. So the advice that a lot of people give writers is write what you know. I really think that's bullshit advice. Can I say that on your podcast? I think that's BS advice. Because what you're telling people then is you're limiting them mostly to autobiography. So write what you know. If you're writing about people, it's going to be a lot of autobiography. I think a much better piece of advice is write about what you think about. So what are your obsessions? What do you care about? That's not easy advice either, because I tell kids like that in high school, said write about what you think about. And the problem is they're not real clear on what they think about. You can see this sometimes when you look at a rough draft of somebody's story, and it's just a vague thing through all of it. So you ask them something like, well, why does your character want to do this? And the writer would say, well, I don't know, I hadn't thought about it. Or what is the setting this character is in? What can the character see and hear and smell and touch and taste in this scene? He says, well, I don't know, I haven't thought about it. Well, they're just not thinking about it. They aren't thinking, they haven't thought through their idea. They haven't considered why it was important to them. I think, you know, where my ideas come from is I pay attention to what I think about. A lot of times it's stupid stuff. I learned that when I was writing the 52 stories, is I'd start on Monday with an idea that just seemed trivial, insignificant, dumb to the bone, but I was on this streak. I had to write something. So I said, well, I'll just mess around with this, and this will be a throwaway story. It'll be awful, but I don't want to break the streak. But by Wednesday or so, I'd start to think, why was I attracted to this thought in the first place? What drew me to it? What made me want to do anything with it? And stories had a tendency to grow. So on Monday, I thought the story was awful, but by Friday, I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a live wire. I really tangled into something interesting here. And I liked it. I of those 52 stories, there's not a single one of them that I didn't think at the end of the week wasn't the best thing I'd written.
Have they all been published?
48 of them have been published. No, 46 of them, sorry.
That's a pretty good track record.
It was a good percentage. The others are still out in the mail. I haven't trunked any of them.
You're actually the second person I've talked to who took that challenge. I was trying to remember who the first writer was. She had actually met Ray Bradbury and then followed his advice.
I think it's good advice. There's a website, or there's probably more than one, but you know, the 52-story a week thing. And I was checking on it. And it was fun to watch what another writer was doing. He was writing very short stuff. His stories were in the 500 to 1,000 word range. For my 52 stories, the average story length was about 3,500 words.
I can barely clear my throat in 500 words. So.
Well, you write almost entirely novels, right?
Yes, it's taken my whole career to be able to put out a short story collection a couple of years ago, and some of those were unpublished, so it was... But that brings me around to that. You have always focused on short stories. Do you think that in general authors tend to go one way or the other? Like short story writers and novelists are a slightly different breed of fish? That's not the right metaphor, but you know what I mean.
No, I think there is a difference between them. And the reason I'm pretty sure of that was for several years when I became eligible for the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer, which is now called the Amazing... They've renamed it.
I don't remember what they renamed it, but I know they
but
did.
But you know, it's not named anymore. At any rate, novelists always get all the attention because they get ads in Locus and they're, you know, featured in Barnes & Noble or something. And it seemed like an incredible number of novelists win the John W. Campbell Award. But short story writers are eligible too. So I thought the reason is there just isn't enough visibility. So I started a website. And for 3 years or 4 years, I think, I did this. I was just gathering together the names of anybody who had crossed the eligibility threshold to be considered a best new writer. And that meant that I was corresponding with all of these new writers. So novelists and short story writers. The novelists, almost all of them, there had always written novels. That's all they'd ever written. And the short story writers, almost all of them, just wrote short stories. When I asked them, you know, that same question, they said, well, that's the length that I'm attracted to. It's really pretty rare to find writers that are significantly good at both, that do both. Like Connie Willis, right? She can knock it out of the park with all of those. But I think most people would say James Patrick Kelly is a stronger short story writer than he is a novelist. I like his novels. But his short stories are the things you think about most. Robert Silverberg seemed to be able to do both with equal skill. It's just, you don't know. Stephen King does novels and short stories. Neil Gaiman does novels and short stories. But most people are one or the other.
I always thought I would be more of a short story writer because that's what I loved short stories when I was, you know, in fact, turning around as if you can see what I'm looking at. On the shelf behind me is... it's a 50s collection, Treasury of the World's Greatest Science Fiction or something like that. It came out in the late 50s, two volumes.
It has. Is it the one with the rocket ships on the back, the red rocket ships on a white cover?
It's only in its interior cover, which is a gray, just gray. I think it has like the weapons shops of Isher in there.
Yeah, I have that collection.
Yeah. And, you know, I loved short stories. And when I started writing, obviously it was short stories because I was young, but I started writing, wrote my first novel when I was 14.
Wow.
And I've been, you know, my thoughts just tend to go that way. So I think there's definitely something to that. So once you've got your idea, now at this point, if you were as a novelist, I would say, and you are a novelist as well, you have written a couple of novels, what is your planning or outlining process look like? With a short story, I presume it's more you just write and see what develops.
Yeah, well, that's how I wrote my novels too. The pantser plotter dichotomy.
Yeah.
Most people are really, it's a spectrum.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty much purely a pantser. My novels read, though, like a short story writer wrote them. Like the first novel I wrote was Summer of the Apocalypse. And I wrote it because I wanted to write my own apocalyptic novel. The apocalyptic novels of my past were very influential to me. So Stephen King's The Stand and...
Did you ever read one called Alas, Babylon?
Yes, Alas, Babylon.
Yeah, that one stuck with me.
Yeah, anyway, they're very good as far as I was concerned. But I'd never written a novel, so I started doing some reading, you know, what is a novel, what makes a novel a novel. And the things that stuck with me were pretty, I don't know, surfacey. But I read somewhere that a novel should be 20 chapters long. And somewhere else, someone said a chapter in a novel should be about 5,000 words long. I've read a lot of novels to know this is not true. But those things stuck with me. So I thought, that's all I need. I need a structure, and then I can write the novel. So I've got 25,000 word boxes to fill, and I'll have a novel when I'm done with that. I wrote a novel that Summer of the Apocalypse alternates the same character's point of view, but when he's 15 and when he's 75. So I thought, okay, I get 10 chapters for the one point of view and 10 for the next. As it turned out, I wanted to end up with the same point of view that I started, so it was 21 chapters long. The rough draft was about 105,000 words, and then I edited from there. Somebody told me, though, it reads very much like a novel written by a short story writer because it's kind of like 21 short stories.
Have you ever been tempted to take a short story and develop it into a novel?
I've been asked a couple times if I would do that, or they thought it was a pretty rich world. I haven't done it. It may be because I have a short attention span. I'm not sure. What makes somebody a natural novelist as opposed to a natural short storyteller? I love all the ceremony of writing, right? I love it when I sit down and I know I'm going to start a new story. So I open up a file, or when I was typing on paper, you know, I put in a fresh sheet of paper. I type my name and address in that upper left-hand corner, and I go down 8 spaces or whatever it is. And now I got to think of a title. It's probably not going to be the title I stick with, but I need a working title. I love that part of it. I love writing the first paragraph. All of that stuff I love. I love returning to the story day after day, if it's a longer short story. And I love knowing what my conclusion is and then writing to it. And if you love those things and you're a novelist, you don't get to do them very often. If you're a short story writer, it turns out you can do it once a week. It's kind of like a shot of heroin.
Yeah, that conclusion you're heading for is a long way off in the distance when you're a novelist. So, what does your actual writing process look like? Do you like to sit in your office somewhere? Or you were a teacher. Did you work on the side while you were teaching? Or were you too busy doing papers and things?
Well, while I was Vance Andall, who I told you about, was my college instructor, had a weird writing process, I thought. He only wrote during the summer. During the school year, he just did schoolwork. He said he didn't have time to, or the headspace to do both, so he just wrote during the summer. One of the very few writers I've ever run into who were as inconsistent as that and were also good. For me, when I finished grad school, I started teaching in 81. I taught until 88, then I took 2 years off to get a degree in creative writing at UC Davis. So when I finished and went back to teaching high school again, I thought those 2 years are going to be a waste unless I'm actually trying to produce work. So I started writing stories, and I'd set a goal for myself of doing 1,000 words a day. I did that because Stephen King said he did 1,000 words a day. That's 4 pages, double-spaced. That's very doable. You can do 1,000 words in an hour if you really know what's, you know, on your mind. It's not even a hard hour. Jay Lake would go a couple thousand words, 2,500 words in an hour. He was just incredible, and a lot of writers, you know, despised him for it secretly. But the problem was that when I was teaching, and I wasn't always on a roll. It doesn't matter. I'm retired now, and I'm still not always on a roll. So I couldn't get the 1,000 words done in an hour. At the end of the hour, I might only have a couple hundred words done. And after a while, I started to look at what time I had left in the day. Like I might get home at 6 o'clock and I got to eat and do all those things and I'm tired. And I go, man, I don't have enough time to do the 1,000 words. So I wouldn't write anything at all. And those days where I didn't write anything at all started to pile up sometimes. And I'd get to the end of the year and I'd add up my total year production because I keep kind of a log of what I've done. And my numbers were terrible. If you write 1,000 words a day, you've got 3 regular sized novels or 1 just big fat fantasy that you've got done at the end of the year. But I was finishing up with 30,000, 40,000 words, you know, and I just was despising myself. And I did that for 9 years. At the end of the 9th year, this is 1999, in November, I was adding up my numbers and I looked like I was going to end up at 35,000. And I just started to feel like kind of a fraud to myself, like I was lying to people when I said I was a writer. At this time, I'd sold quite a bit of short fiction, but I just thought, but it's a fraud. I'm not really writing much. And so I asked myself, what would make me happy? This year I wrote 35,000. Would doubling that make me happy? That'd be 70,000. So I said, sure, yeah, I'd be a lot happier with 70,000. And I did the math. How much is that? That's 200 words a day if I don't miss any days. So I downgraded from 1,000 words a day to 200 a day. I did that in November of 1999, and I haven't missed a day since.
And they add up.
They do. That's 200 words a day. You're finishing a short story about every month.
Do you? You must sometimes go more than that.
Yeah, right. If 200 is the minimum,
that's not even.
I can do 200. Between the time I got to school, checked my lesson plans, have my copies ready to go, and before students show up, I can do it during lunch. I can do it during a planning period. I can do it during a faculty meeting and look like I'm taking notes. I can do it. Right after school or right before I go to bed. 200 words is doable. And the other nice thing about 200 words is instead of thinking of a 4-page chunk being the minimum amount of writing I'm doing, less than a page counts. So I can have a 200-word chunk several times a day. If I have different times that are available to me, I can return to the story and, well, let's write the rest of that dialogue, or let's have a character into the scene, or let's just go back and do that description you sort of skipped over early. So yeah, I have a lot of days that are over 1,000. I haven't had, I don't think I've been under 100,000 words since 1999 in a year, and pretty good in other places. I wrote, the 2 years that I wrote novels were pretty good years because, you know, novel's a lot of words, and I was on a roll. The second novel I did is, I started as a NaNoWriMo novel, Pandora's Gun, so 50,000 words in a month. And then it took a month to write it and 2 years to edit it.
Have you always been a keyboard writer, or do you ever write longhand?
My handwriting is terrible. And
mine too.
as a teacher, my handwriting on the whiteboard or on the blackboard when I was writing with chalk, it always looked like it was in the midst of a seizure. So as soon as possible, when I was in junior high, I got a typewriter. And for my own writing and everything else I do, I've been a keyboard person pretty much all along. I'll do poetry sometimes on a notebook, and a couple times when my computer's been on the fritz, I've written longhand. But I have to retype it right away or I won't be able to read it in a couple months.
I was a newspaper reporter, and this was in the 80s, so we didn't have, you know, a phone to sit out there and record what people were saying. And so I would take handwritten notes, and if I didn't get those notes typed up later that afternoon, I would be calling people up to say, did you really say something about a bald polar bear, or am I misreading? I know. So once you have a short story draft, what does your revision process look like?
I do multiple passes through a short story. And some of it starts right from when I begin writing. If it's not a one sit-down story, and there are some of those. I've written flash fiction, the Daily Science Fiction, which is a great place for stories under 1,500 words. I last year discovered Drabbles, which I'd never heard of before. That's a story of exactly 100 words. And there's a professional market for Drabbles. It's called Martian, the magazine of science fiction Drabbles. They pay pro rates. It's $8 for a story, but it's pro rates, and it's a great, fun exercise, a short story in 100 words. So, but if I'm not doing that, if it takes more than a single day, what happens is I open up the file from the day before and I read through what I've written. I will make changes on that if I see things that need to be changed. Sometimes it's proofreading, although I'm not tightly proofreading. It's just, you know, well, that's stupid. I spelled that word by missing two letters. Let's fix it now. I'm going to have to fix it later. But I also am revisiting the story and rethinking the story. And sometimes during that reread, I'll add more or subtract more or reorganize. And then I'll start tacking on the new words for the day. And I keep doing that. If it takes me 10 days to write a short story, that first section has been looked over 10 times already. It's starting to get pretty tight. And that it doesn't matter if it's pretty tight, if the last page I did something that sends a ripple effect backwards in the manuscript, and I got to go back and set up what I did because it was a late thought I had or something like that. You know, that sort of thing. So there's continuity pass, there's a sensory pass, there's just a pure sentence rhythm pass, just reading stuff out loud.
I was going to say, do you read out loud?
Yeah, I like reading out loud. That way I can hear the rhythm of my language as I go. I think that having started off as a poet is a good thing for me as a writer. I think the distance between really well-written prose and poetry is much smaller than most people think. Read any Peter S. Beagle out loud, read Tolkien out loud, read Bradbury out loud. The language beats are cool to listen to, and they make them fun, I think. I can also hear, like if I repeated the same unique sounding word too close to itself or used it more than once. Sometimes there's some words you can only put in a manuscript once because it'll call itself back. And then the last thing I do when I think it's pretty tight that way is I'll rework the ending several times, trying different ways. Because in a short story, it's a novel too, but in a short story, a lot of it is about landing the ending. So try to make that ending worth the journey so that last page grows. That one definition of a poem is it's a piece of writing that contains more than the sum of its parts. Mm. And I think that the end of a short story should be like that. And then the very last thing is I'll use Ken Rand's 10% solution and just go through looking for wordiness, which I'm catching along the way too, but Ken Rand's the 10% solution I recommend to everybody who is interested in writing because it gives them a real practical kind of step-to-step guide. Here's a way to eliminate common wordiness in your text. Are you familiar with that book? Do you know it? Have you heard about it?
I think I've heard of it. I've never seen it. For me, okay. It always goes back to what my professor called the little book, which was Strunk and White, Elements of Style. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of that sort of thing in there, too, of, you know, eliminate surplus verbiage or something like that.
Yeah, right. Always say the least number of words that the task demands. Sometimes the least number of words is a lot of words. I think that, like, take the first sentence of The Fall of the House of Usher. That's a really wordy sentence. But there isn't a single word in there that's redundant. They all work. And I think that that's really cool when I read Poe. He's not redundant. I can't say the same of Lovecraft, but Poe is not redundant. At any rate, the 10% solution just leverages your computer's ability to help you out and edit. It is a short list of words that create wordiness, starting with all the forms of be. So I just go through and I look for all the times I use the word was or were. So am is are, was, were, be, being, and been. Those are parts of either helping verb sentences or linking verb sentences. Many of them can be rewritten as action verb sentences, and the prose will read crisper. It'll be more specific. Like if somebody writes a sentence, it was a nice day. There's nothing wrong with that sentence. It's in English. It's understandable to English speakers. There's no grammar problem in there. And for a fiction writer, it sucks. That's just a bad sentence. It was a nice day. Well, give me a break. My job is to explain to the reader, to create for the reader the world of the story. So a breeze blew briskly across the porch, rattling the wind chimes, is wordier, but way more specific. And that doing that linking verb search helps me find all those. I try never to have a linking verb sentence in a story if I can. I never succeed, but you know, just I put myself on a linking verb diet. Same thing with helping verbs. So she was running down the street. The was search gives me the was. And I realize, oh, she ran down the street. I wouldn't say she was running unless I'm going to interrupt her in some way. Like she was running down the street when the building exploded or something like that. And most of the time that's not. And then, you know, other words, I go for an ly search and it catches needless adverbs because I didn't trust my verb or adjective or adverb to be specific enough. It catches redundancies. So if I wrote a sentence like, she screamed loudly, which is just on the surface dumb, because screamed means, right? If she screamed silently, that might make sense, because you're working against the definition. Now, like, a shot rang out suddenly. That's a classic one, too.
Yeah, as opposed to a slow shot.
Shots. So it just gets me searching for those things. And what I like about it is because it's using the computer to search for things for me, it's all of a sudden highlighting sentences out of context. Mm. So when I read through and I'm revising, because I wrote it, right? I knew what I had in mind when I wrote it. And when I read it, I see the things I had in mind. And everything is where I put it. So it all looks proper. If I go out of context, though, and I just start picking out individual sentences and go, oh, well, that sentence is kind of clumsy, isn't it? And can go back and look at it with fresh eyes. A friend of mine used to be an editor for a legal firm. And to get away from that, you know, the hypnotizing rhythm of your sentence going in a linear fashion forward, she would edit by reading the sentences from back to front. Not the sentence backwards, but she'd read the last sentence first. And then the second to last sentence next. So she was saying, I'm not worried right now about how these sentences connect. I know they do. I'm worried about how each individual sentence is working. And that sounds tedious, but I'm not sure that the things that are publishable most of the time don't get that attention to detail. On a short story of a couple thousand words, I'll spend a whole day editing it. I don't just proofread it for spelling errors and then put it in the mail. That's a mistake.
I've heard of doing that, the sentence backwards, for proofreading in particular, because it breaks up the rhythm of reading, where when you're reading your own stuff in particular, your eye sees what you meant to be there, or words that, I don't know about you, but as I get older, I find that my hands have a mind of their own, and I'll type like the first two letters correctly in a word, and then the brain says, oh, I know what word that is, and bangs out something that's not actually the right word at all.
Yeah.
And it's from, you know, exactly 40 years of typing, basically.
Yeah, kids will do it too, though. I'd have students, I told them about reading out loud as a proofreading exercise to help them hear their mistakes. But kids will read sentences from that they wrote that were missing words. They didn't write the word in, and they'll read it out loud and put the word in. They still don't see that they didn't have it in there. So the secret for them is to have a writing partner read their manuscript back to them. So the person who didn't know where the words are supposed to go is going to stumble at error areas, and then they can go back and catch those. I found that to be pretty helpful for them too.
So all the years of teaching, do you think that's improved your own writing? You talked about having to think about idea generation and all that sort of thing. Do you find that the teaching and talking and thinking about creative writing for decades has really improved your own craft?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything that I get enthused about teaching, when I was in the classroom, I was enthused because it was something I was working on my own writing. You know, how do you tell somebody how to write descriptions? How do you tell somebody how to create a character? You have to think pretty hard about it to be able to tell somebody else about it, and for that helps me, right? The other thing besides teaching that I thought grew me as a writer more than anything else was reading slush piles. Mm. You know, reading to acquire stories for a magazine. You start seeing stuff. When you're all you have is your writing input is professionally published work that you adore, and you don't really think about it as a critiquer, At least you don't when you start, when you're young. And then your own work, you have nothing to compare it to. But if you read a slush pile, you start to see, you know, if you're reading, I don't know, 50 stories a week, pretty soon you'll see the kind of things that are errors in the writing because you see them in more than one manuscript. And you go, or you also see cliches too, like this is, oh my gosh, this is another story that starts like this, and these are characters saying these things. But more importantly than that is I started to see the things that I was doing in my own writing in the slush pile. And if I'm reading a story and I go, oh, this is where this story went off the rails for me. Oops, I did that on my story too. That's really helpful. So reading slush helps me write because I'm always thinking about how does another reader read this. It aids in clarity, but it also aids in the thing that frustrated me most as a slush reader was familiarity. So over and over again, people describing things in a similar fashion and dialogue following a similar pattern and characters saying cliched things to each other, it makes me hate the familiar and try not to make my story guilty of that. So I set myself a goal of every story that I've, of anything I write, every page of every story I write needs to have at least one gem on it. And a gem is something on the page that makes you, surprises you a little bit, is something that is fresh. It can be just the wording of a sentence, but it could be a clever bit of dialogue. It could be the naming of a bar. It could be a nice couple word metaphor. Just anything that makes the manuscript at that point be something you could comment on. What's sad that I saw in the slush, and then I started to see it in my own writing, is page after page where the prose is serviceable, the story is being told, but there's not much attention being paid to the I don't know, it sounds pretentious, the art of it, the craft of it, the joy of it. And for me, a lot of good reading is about seeing those things. Sometimes not consciously, I'll see them a second time through. Like when I read The Last Unicorn, Peter S. Beagle's The Last Unicorn, the first couple pages were just startling because he's so poetic in what he's doing. But pretty soon I'm just lost in the story and I get all the way in. I go, God, that was a dynamite story. So I go back and reread. Now I can read slower and I'm not being surprised by plot points. And I see, no, he was being interesting and clever and awesome on a sentence level all the way through. And I think that the best of professional writing, or at least the best of the writing that I admire and that I aspire to, has that feature in it. Maybe not to the density of Peter S. Beagle or Ray Bradbury or something, but just an attention to the specific, the unique, and the artful that make reading so worthwhile. When I was reading slush so often, it was just page after page of okay prose. And I know I'm not going to buy that, probably. But just okay prose won't do it. Very seldom is somebody telling such a compelling story that the language isn't necessary to support it. I just don't believe that happens. I think they go together.
One of the things we've been doing is our kitchen is not conducive to working side by side in, so my wife will work on cooking and I will read out loud. We've read our way through, I don't know how many books at this point, massive ones too, like the book that Hamilton is based on, the biography. But one thing I really find out reading out loud is every once in a while I'll just stop and say, that was really well written. And Watership Down, for example, we read that recently and beautifully written all the way through, and just read The Wind and the Willows, which I had never read before. And there's a lot of great language in there. So I find that reading out loud, I often find those things more, whereas my brain will sometimes sort of zip ahead because I'm looking for the plot. And again, just like in your own prose, reading out loud makes you slow down and really, really listen to it, literally. Well, we're close to the end here, so I'm going to ask you my big philosophical questions. The first one is, why do you write? The second one is, why do any of us write? Why do people tell stories? And the third one is, why science fiction, fantasy stories, speculative fiction, whatever term you like to encompass everything with, why those kinds of stories specifically. So why do you write?
I got interested in stories and being a storyteller pretty early, I think, in elementary school. As I mentioned, I'd read Ray Bradbury, and he made me laugh sometimes. He made me cry. You know, those are really obvious things, but he just made me feel, he moved me with his stories. Sometimes I was startled. Sometimes I was holding my breath in anticipation. And that just seemed like such a cool magic trick to be able to do it. And I wanted to be able to do it too. I thought that would be something if I could accomplish that, because I had thoughts about things in the world that I thought were interesting and fun and captured my attention. If I could somehow in words capture somebody else's attention that way, that would be awesome. I think that was it. And then later on, writing keeps throwing up these interesting challenges for me. I've kind of come to believe that there's no writing roadblock. There's nothing that's impossible in writing. There's no challenge that can't be met. There's no, you know, somebody says, well, take these two items and turn it into a story, and they give you some really disparate things. Or tell a story that's based on some song in the 40s, or, you know, whatever. I like the challenge. And then I also find that storytelling is very self-analytic. There's this great story. It's probably more story than you need to know here, but it's a story about this high school kid who was such a problem that he was on the edge of being expelled. And they brought him into the counseling office and said, look, you're antisocial. You don't follow rules. We're going to kick you out of this school, but we want to give you one more chance. And here's the chance. You got to sign this contract to be a better kid around everybody else. But we also want you to see the school's therapist once a week. You go in and talk to him, and he will give you the clearance to do the next week. So the first week, the kid goes into the therapist, and he's, you know, on the edge of not being in school anyways. And the therapist said, tell me what you dream. And the kid says, what? You know what I want to be? He says, no, what you dream? What you dream at night? And the kid thinks, well, this is bullshit. So he just makes up some stuff and talks for a half hour, and the therapist lets him go. And the next week he comes back, and the therapist asks the same question. What were your dreams? What did you dream this week? And somehow they manage to get through the whole year. The kid doesn't get expelled. He's going to graduate, and he's meeting the last time with this therapist, and they've got kind of close. I mean, he never really liked him. They weren't friends or anything, but the kid felt bad, and he said, look, I have to tell you the truth. Every time I've come in here and you told me to tell you my dreams, I just made stuff up. I just lied. I wasn't going to tell anybody what I really dream. And the therapist said, I know, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I love that story, because the kid's inventions were just as revealing as the things that he was actually dreaming. That no matter what it is that I write, there's some reason that I hooked onto that. And I get interested in, why was this compelling? Why was this 2 or 3 page beginning that I thought was just trivial and small and kind of silly, why did I do that? And what deeper thing within me wanted to say those things? And then it gets very, I'm writing for myself. I'm writing to try to discover what it was that was interesting about that. So those are all reasons for me to write. I do like external validation. I love to see my name in a table of contents. I love to see my name on the back of a book. I remember I was at an early WorldCon after I'd started publishing some in Analog and other places, and I was on a panel with Gardner Dozois and Connie Willis and, you know, a couple other just of my idols. And I finished the panel, and I had to rush from the room because I was supposed to be in the dealer's room at the Asimov's table, where I was scheduled to do a signing at the exact minute my panel ended. It was all the way across the convention center. So I'm rushing from the room, and somebody stops me at the door, and they said, Mr. Van Pelt, could you sign my book? I have your book. And I'm signing it, and I'm kind of frustrated because I'm in a hurry, and then I think, oh my God, every dream I've ever had is coming true this very second.
And why do you think any of us do this somewhat odd activity of putting stories down on paper, well, or at least on pixels these days?
I suppose, you know, everybody has their reasons. I've had writers tell me that they write because they want to make money. I mean, really, I didn't think that this was possible. I thought that you had to be somehow compelled by higher reasons than that. But there's a romance writer in Grand Junction where I live who I was on a panel with her, and it was a college panel. It wasn't a convention. It was a college thing, a college writing seminar. And so there was a poet from the university and myself and somebody else and this romance writer. And the poet from the university was asked, the whole panel was asked, where do you get your inspiration? And she kind of did that sort of tilt up to the ceiling look. And she said, well, I kind of let the waves of the universe imbue me with the spirit of the language. And she goes on for a while. And I can almost hear the romance writer, who was a friend of mine, her eyes rolling in her sockets during all this. And they got to the romance writer and says, I write because I get paid for it. I put my butt in a chair and I put words down on the page and people pay me for it. And that's what I write for. And I asked her about that. She said, no, that's actually it. That's why she writes. But I think other people write for all kinds of reasons. They write because that's their self-image. They call themselves a writer. That could be it for me too. My identity as a writer is somehow tied with all this. I think that if I skipped days or I quit writing, I'd somehow feel empty. So maybe a little of that. Or they love to entertain people. They were the kind of person that could tell a story and they got attention for that. You know, there's a gazillion reasons why they do it. I just don't think that probably for most writers that they know that they would say that money is the reason. And certainly the groupies are way, way overrated as far as I can tell. And, you know, all that stuff you saw, if you watched Nathan Fillion in Castle, writers' lives aren't like his. Nobody is sending a limo around for you. You know, George R. R. Martin going to a convention and being surrounded by his retinue because he needs it. He's a one of a kind. For the rest of us, we can just wander around. I was in a drugstore in Glenwood Springs. Glenwood Springs is about, 280 miles from Greeley, where Connie Willis lives. And I ran into Connie Willis in this drugstore. She was out on the western slope where I live vacationing. You know, pretty cool coincidence to run into Connie there. And I'm talking to her and other people are going by and they're buying all of their stuff. And I'm thinking, don't they realize this is Connie Willis? This is multiple Hugo, Nebula, Locus Award winner, life-changing author whose Lincoln Dreams altered the course of my writing life. None of them knew who she was. She was just Connie Willis. She has to go to a convention for anybody to make a to-do of her. So I think people that think they're writing for fame are sorely mistaken.
And then what draws us to the stories of the fantastic as opposed to just telling stories of the here and now and what really happens as opposed to what might happen or never could happen?
I know, that's a good question too. When I was doing my graduate work at UC Davis, I was writing science fiction and fantasy. For a lot of people, when they get involved with the academy in some way or another, there's at least I hear stories of science fiction and fantasy writers and horror writers are kind of on the low end of the pecking scale and they're not really respected for doing what they're doing. I was told that the reason they accepted me at UC Davis is that the person who was doing the selection committee was just one person, mistook me for a magical realist. And took my stuff. A friend of mine sold a poem to Asimov's, and I asked her about it because she's not a science fiction-y person at all. And she said, oh, they took my metaphor literally, thought it was science fiction, and bought it. So, you know, there's various reasons for it. I just have a tendency to spin things that way. I find them more interesting personally. Also, I think that all those science fictional elements and fantasy elements and horror elements also do work metaphorically. I mean, there's an urge to climb onto a spaceship and fly away, and a story can make that pretty literal, but the urge is metaphorical. The hope that you can see things from a farther away perspective, or that you can escape, or that you can explore and find things anew. There's a great movie, The Truman Show, most fans know it. And Truman wanted to be an explorer, and everything in his society tried to prevent him from being an explorer because they didn't want him to leave this set that was the world that he existed in. But his idea about looking at maps and wanting to go to places that nobody went before, well, they were right in one way. There's no place left to explore, really, on Earth. There are, but... Not quite the same as here there be dragons, right, on the maps. Not quite in that same way. But in fiction, you can explore anywhere, you can go anywhere. And I like that limitless ability to it. Plus, it gives me an excuse to get lyrical with my language sometimes, which I probably can do if I was writing more mainstream stuff. I have written some mainstream stuff. It's just my tendency is always, where's the magical element or where's the science fictional element? I don't know why I go that way. I do. I had somebody at grad school ask me, another one of the writers, ask me why I did it that way, why I wrote science fiction and fantasy. And she said, why do you put so many layers in between you and your true material? I thought that was a really cool way to phrase that question. And it was filled with so many assumptions. So I couldn't answer her except to tell her, no, that actually is my material. Yes, I'm dealing with things metaphorically, but aren't you? I mean, fiction is fiction. Even biography and history somehow is trying to tell the truth, but using it with the tools of a lie, which is language and the distancing mechanism of picking and choosing your details.
Yeah, I've often made that point with any writer that, you know, writers that don't write in the fantastical, that even if you're writing what appears to be a story set in the here and now, it's not. It's set in a fictional version of the here and now, a fantastical version that you have shaped, just like just like we shape our fantastical worlds. Just shaped to look a little bit more like the real world, but it's still very much a fictional, fantastical place in its own way.
Plus, I think it's just
that
fun.
That too.
I mean, I tell people sometimes that I'm probably about 19, you know, mentally.
I'm not sure I'm even there.
But really, yeah, I think I'm more like 8. I like to be sitting in the sandbox, I think, and just shaping things and making them. And that was a magic time. And in your brain, when you're a science fiction writer or a fantasy writer, oh my gosh, you're 8.
And what are you shaping in your sandbox now? What are you working on?
I'm working on, I always seem to be tackling stories that are beyond my ability to write them. Right now I'm writing a story that's science fictional, just a little bit in the future, set in a high school English classroom, which is a setting I return to fairly often. But in this high school classroom, the students have much more access to online stuff, including contacts, which function like Google glasses, where you can dress the world up any way you want it to look. So in my class, one of the students is very religious and everything in the world appears to be either heaven or hell, depending upon how the algorithm has judged it, including people around him. So my teacher is trying to teach the class, all of them distracted electronically, including this one student with his ICAPs, they're called. She's trying to teach them Hamlet and going through the play, and she's on the edge of retirement and trying to judge her own career, and she's worried about these kids, and all this stuff mixed together with Hamlet is so much fun. And also, I think beyond my capability to write it, and that's probably where I should be every time I'm writing a story is, oh no, I need more skill.
Do you have any more collections or anything like that coming up?
Well, The Best of James Van Pelt came out in 2019, I think. It just got, we couldn't go to World Fantasy because of COVID. So would that be 220, 219?
Yeah, 220,
220, I guess. And so that's my latest work, and we are still selling those sort of by hand. There were 200 copies of the signed limited hardbound edition, and I think we have about 40 of them left. We'll be releasing the electronic version and a trade paperback version of that pretty soon. Patrick Swenson, who is the editor at Fairwood Press, has seemed to buy something from me or ask me for something about every 2 or 3 years. So I've got enough that it's possible another collection could be coming, but nothing in the works right now. I do have a story that'll appear in Analog sometime soon. The next issue of Asimov's will have a story in it of mine. I always have stuff circulating. I have 13 or 14 manuscripts in the mail right now, and I have the manuscripts that I'm working on. I just got a rejection today from the magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, who I've been sending stuff to since 1984 and never sold a story to them. But it's the first personal rejection that I got from Sherry. It's Sherry Renee Thomas is the new editor. And I thought, well, that's a good step forward. I've got personal rejections from, five different editors at the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. That's some sort of accomplishment. I don't know what.
And where can people find you online?
I am on Facebook, and I'm searched for James Van Pelt. You'll find me. I think it's James Van Pelt 14 at Facebook.com or whatever it is, however that goes. I'm also at jamesvanpelt.com, where I post irregularly, but I have links to all my stuff there. So mostly I'm active on Facebook.
All right. Well, that should do it. So thanks so much for being on The World Shapers, Jim. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you for asking me. It's kind of fun to chat this way.
And thanks again to James Van Pelt, Jim, for being my guest on this episode of the podcast of The World Shapers. That was a great conversation. I certainly enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. And that brings us to the conclusion. I would like to point out a few things. First of all, that The World Shapers can be found online at theworldshapers.com, on Twitter at The World Shapers, on Facebook, where Jim is most active, at The World Shapers. You can also find me at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, W-I-L-L-E-T-T. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. You can find me on YouTube at Edward Willett, where I do live stream walks, but there's a lot of other stuff there, and some of it is also science fiction and fantasy related. So just Edward Willett, youtube.com/EdwardWillett. You can find me on Instagram at Edward Willett Author, and you can find me on Facebook at Edward.Willett. You can also find Shadow Paw Press, my publishing company, which will be bringing out Shapers of Worlds Volume 3, among other things. That's the third volume featuring authors who are guests on this podcast. You can find it at shadowpawpress.com, on Twitter at Shadow Paw Press, on Instagram at Shadow Paw Press, and on Facebook at Shadow Paw Press. I have other websites, but maybe I won't mention them all. I have an E.C. Blake website. I have a Shards of Excalibur website. But those are the main ones. So that's where you can find out more information. Just before I really wrap up, though, I do have to remind you that The World Shapers is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Direct West. Are you a business owner looking for new avenues to promote your business? Direct West digital billboards are a great opportunity to highlight a new product, a new promotion, or anything else you'd like your customers to know about. You can get local expert marketing help for your business at directwest.com.
Thanks to Direct West and the other sponsors of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network for their support. Lots of great podcasts in this province, and mine's one of them, I like to think. So that really is the end. Again, thanks for listening, and do come back many times in the future as I continue to talk to the authors who have created the worlds and characters and the fantastic worlds and fantastic characters that we've enjoyed so much over the years. That's it for now. Goodbye.